everyone, and welcome to episode 282 of the Board Game Barbecue Podcast, brought to you by Advent Games and our Patreons. My name is Lauren. I'll be your host for this evening, and I'm joined today by the very lovely Dan. Dan, how's it going, mate?
I've been called many things, never been accused of being lovely, but I'll take it.
I know. This is the one shot to throw some niceties your way, Dan.
Nice. I'll take what I can get.
Beautiful. And we've also got a full house today of some guests. So really excited to have the team responsible for the upcoming game Galactic Cruise, which we'll be talking about. So we've got TK King. How's it going?
Doing great. Excited to be here.
Awesome. And Colton.
Hey. Yeah, it's great. Great to be here. Looking forward to this.
Amazing. And then also Dennis in the third guest chair.
Yeah, great to have. Thanks for having us.
Amazing. So I guess we'll just kick it off to you guys. We'd love to hear a little bit about your collaborations. It's not often we get to have such a big kind of team of guests together.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So I guess we'll start maybe just with kind of the elevator pitch for Galactic Cruise for kind of our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the game.
Sure. Yeah. So Galactic Cruise is a 1-4 player competitive kind of medium heavy Euro worker placement game where players take on the role of a supervisor of Galactic Cruise to help build and launch shuttles to send guests on luxurious space vacations. So it is worker placement, action selection, kind of building your tableau of shuttles to launch throughout the game to send the different guest types to the different places that they want to travel to.
Sounds great. And Laura and I both had an opportunity to play the game. It is very, very cool. We'll be able to do a bit more of a deep dive into the game. I just wanted to just ask, company is called Kinson Key Games. What were the origins of Kinson Key?
I'll let Colton answer that one.
Yeah, so originally when we started this kind of journey of designing and publishing, it was just TK and I. So when we named the company, we took the first three letters from his last name, so the K-I-N from King, the S-O-N from Thompson, which is my last name. And then we enjoyed alliteration, so we went with Key. Kinson Key sounded good. Little did we know that we actually had a real key to the company living up in Canada that we hadn't met yet. So when we brought Dennis on, we were like, well, I guess you're the key we've been waiting for.
Oh, there you go.
So yeah, that's kind of the short version. We pretty much stole it, you know, from Stonemaier, you know, the idea of, you know, Alan Stone and Jamie Stegmaier putting their names together. It's like, oh yeah, yeah. Kinson Key.
I feel stupid I didn't pick that, actually. Just quietly.
Yeah, I don't need to give you smack talk, Dan. You just do it for yourself.
Yeah.
So how do you guys kind of work as a team? I'd love to hear about the division of labor, how you guys all work and collaborate, and what you guys kind of bring to make this game a reality.
Yeah, as Colton mentioned, it did start out with just him and myself. We worked on the game for about a year, and then we ended up meeting Dennis at Proto ATL. He played the game, really enjoyed it, and then kind of came on board as a playtester, and then would stick around for a little while after just in the development of the game, talking about how we can fix things and make it better. And at some point we were just like, you know, we feel like you're more of a developer than a playtester, and then more of a part of the team. And so we decided to bring him onto the company. And eventually it was just like, we feel like your name should be on the box. And so he slowly worked his way from a playtester to, you know, a third of the company, and of course has his name on a box. And at this point, like, he's got just as much DNA in the game as Colton and I. But it's been great to have all three of us working together, just because we all kind of have different strengths. And so just the ability to kind of be flexible in what we do and how much time we spend on certain things has really been great.
So even in those early days, Dennis, what was it about the game that really captured you and you thought, this is something that these guys have got something here?
So yeah, it's interesting because it wasn't even that I was thinking like, oh, I want to be a part of this. like I didn't have any intentions of, you know, the joining.
Takeover, hostile takeover.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was literally just at Proto ATL. I had three of my own games that I was working on that I brought, and I played Galactic Cruise. I did like the game. The theme was cool. The different action selection stuff was cool. And it was a very different game back then. Like, there was a set number of rounds, and hiring an extra worker would give you more actions for that round. Very different from where it is now, but it was definitely like the bones. I saw the potential in the game. The bones were good. And it was just an interesting interesting theme, interesting gameplay. So I liked it off the bat, but I was just became instant friends with TK. Colton wasn't actually there at the first thing because his wife had just had a baby. So I didn't meet him till a little bit later, but we met online, you know, pretty soon after that, like after I met TK in person, like I joined the Discord server and there was a lot of other designers that kind of were connected through the Kins and Key Discord server. So there was a lot of just kind of up and coming designers meeting, playtesting each other with each other online. And so I just kept hanging out with them a lot and I liked working on the game. I liked the collaborative process of working together because I had all the games that I had designed before. It was just me. So I didn't have anyone to, you know, kind of bounce things off of and talk about things. And we definitely had, you know, different kind of backgrounds or experience with games. And so it was really, really cool to see, you know, like I find it's really interesting that we all kind of pull the game in our own direction. And like the best thing is kind of each of us pulling in our own direction. So it's like, okay, let's not go as far as to what I think it should be, but we need to pull a little bit in that way. And then so let's go as far as Colton wants it to be, but let's go a little bit in that direction. And it just kind of ends up being the best overall with all three of us putting stuff together. So your earlier question about like the division of labor, there's definitely certain things that some people are more focused on. Like I am the first to admit that you won't really see me active on social media much. That's just not really my thing. TK and Colton are on there constantly, and that's a very important part. So I'm not doing much of that. But for other stuff with the game, it's like we don't really say like, oh, TK, work on this part of the game. Colton, work on that part of the game. Dennis, work on this part of the game. It's like all three of us are working on it at the same time and kind of shaping it as it goes.
You alluded, Dennis, to kind of making a lot of iterations and changes. And when you first were brought to the game, it looked very different to how it does now. I'd love to hear from the three of you kind of how the game has evolved, you know, what you started with and what was the intention initially to kind of where you've ended up now.
No, I was going to say, I think that the game evolved as we did for sure, because the initial version, like the very first version that that TK brought to me was it was basically viticulture, but the action spaces were, you know, about getting parts for your ship and installing them. But it was basically getting your grapes, making your wine, fulfilling some wine orders. But then, like, as we played other games, like we played, you know, as we started getting into Vital Lacerda's games, like my favorite designer is Alexander Pfister. So for me, it was like, how many different things can this card do? So just kind of as we played more games, kind of really honed in kind of as our taste of kind of evolved, the game has to. We played Ark Nova when it came out. And there was a teensy little part of Ark Nova that we're like, oh, that's really cool, that made it into the game. So I would say, like, on one level there, it's just that as we played more games, because TK and I are actually fairly newish into the board gaming hobby, as far as like the actual like hobby game side of it. So yeah, I would definitely say that in that way, the game has gone through many iterations, just as we have figured out what we really like in games. TK, what were you going to say about that though?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, like, it all started off with a text message to Colton. I had been holding the kind of idea concept of the game for a long time. I tend to do that. Like, I don't want to share it unless I actually think it's good. And so I texted him one day, and I think we're going to share this at some point coming up to the launch of the game. But I texted him the idea and concept for the game, and it's very similar to what it ended up being as far as theme goes. And then I kind of went from there with the first playtest being really terrible, more like a simulation of a spaceship company than an actual fun game. Because I think our first two-player game took 4 hours to play, and we didn't really do anything. Like, nothing really was accomplished. And so it's just been really cool to see it transition from that to what it is today.
Nice. TK, being such a fan of Vital Lacerda games yourself, I think there's three of his games in your top 10 in your biography on your website. I was curious, how difficult is it to try and create an original game or a game that's your own that takes all the mechanics of those games that you love without trying to sort of imitate them and trying to still bring something fresh and original to Galactic Cruise?
Yeah, I think a lot of that had to do with kind of what Colton was saying about kind of our timeline of jumping into the hobby. Because when we had first started working on Galactic Cruise, I don't think either of us had ever played a Lacerda game. And so as we started playing those games, a lot of those elements started infiltrating, but we couldn't just steal them, right? We if we liked something, we would have to take it and transform it into what Galactic Cruise needed. And so it was never just, hey, take this thing and put it in. It was like, hey, we love this idea and concept or this how this mechanic works or how this makes us feel as players. How can that be implemented into Galactic Cruise? So I think if starting from the beginning, we were like, hey, let's design Lacerda, it would probably have been a really terrible road to go down. But because we kind of experienced his games along the way as we were designing and we were implementing those few things as we come across them, that definitely kind of allowed it to be fresh and to feel like it came through Galactic Cruise as opposed to just being, you know, stolen and tried to fit when it didn't need to fit.
Yeah, wow, awesome. I just so intrigued, you guys said that you were kind of quite new to the hobby when you started this design journey. I would love to know more about what was kind of the springboard that made you guys say, yeah, let's design a board game.
So I know for TK and I, we have always played games. So, you know, growing up, like our families, we played all the kind of classic, you know, Monopoly, Clue, Trouble, Sorry, those kinds of games. We played Catan. Somewhere in our, I don't know, early, mid-20s, we discovered, like, Carcassonne, Ticket to Ride. So we'd played kind of, I guess, what you would now call, like, some of the gateways. And we kind of thought that was it. We didn't have this concept of just how big the board game hobby was. And then in 2020, when COVID-19 pandemic kind of shut everything down, we were just hanging out in our houses. And in the past, like, we had designed little games like for friends and whatnot. But TK texted me and he said, hey, we should design a game because we suddenly have all this free time. Because I am a teacher at my day job and we were suddenly just doing remote learning at home. So I was spending a ton of time at home. And I said, yeah, let's do it. Let's design a game. So we designed a little kind of recipe fulfillment sort of card game that we actually thought was quite good. We thought we play tested it. Looking back now, we're like, this is almost like the student film version of like
exactly
whatever. It's like we were really proud of it. But now we look back, we're like, well, it's no Galactic Cruise, but
is this Deliverous?
It is Deliverous. Sure, nice. Is. We made a BGG entry for it, so now
yep.
For decades, people can be like, now what is this first game of yours? And it's like, well. But no, we took it to Kickstarter. We had a super low funding goal. I think our funding goal was $2,500. We ended up with $3,400. We just did like a print on demand. We fulfilled it ourselves, hand addressing all the envelopes.
Wow.
We sent it out. But during that time, we were like, well, I guess we need to do a little organic marketing. So we had hopped into these Facebook groups. We saw kind of what's out there. What does hobby gaming actually look like? We just started buying stuff up. That's kind of where like all of our fun money went, was buying all these games we saw people posting about.
Sounds familiar.
I know that this interview is audio only, but you all can see the shelves behind TK and I.
Yes.
We didn't have any of this stuff a few years ago. And so it was a pretty rapid jump into the hobby.
And on a teacher's salary as well. That's damn impressive.
Yeah. So yeah, my wife and I are both teachers. But this is what I do. This is like my thing.
And because Colton and I live so close together, we don't double buy. So like my shelf is different than his because we always play together.
Smart.
So we're able to kind of not have to buy everything. So that's very nice.
So do you guys ship stuff up to Dennis in Winnipeg, or you just got to fend for yourself, Dennis, when it comes to your collection?
So I have a much longer history of playing the hardcore gamer games and things like that. I always find it so interesting. Like TK and Colton are so great at design, and like I forget that they haven't played as many games or been around it as long, because they're so good at like pinpointing exactly what's interesting about this game or why they like that game. I played games pretty seriously. Like I have a game group that meets at my house every Saturday, and we've been meeting for about 17 years or approximately that long. I have to actually figure it out at some point because I keep getting asked about this kind of question. But it's been a long time, and we hardly ever missed a week until COVID, of course. So we played a lot of stuff, and we played all the time. And so I have a pretty large collection. It would need a 360 degree camera to kind of capture it, because it takes my upstairs room. I have like a big table that I built years ago, and it's surrounded by games. So they have not shipped any. I mean, I've gotten prototypes of Galactic Cruise and things like that. But no, we don't, my collection does not overlap with theirs. I actually tend to bring, whenever I come down, I tend to bring something from my collection that they have never heard or seen, because I've been in it a lot longer. There's some older games that I still find are really cool that maybe didn't really, you know, stick around, like some games, you know, kind of evergreen, or, you know, they're still popular to this day, but there's a ton of stuff that comes out every year, as we all know, that, you know, I've never played or never heard of. And so, especially some of the older stuff, I like bringing stuff to them to show them.
We love a good hidden gem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. So you guys said that the early inspiration of the game originally looked a little bit more like Viticulture, which I find really interesting, because, you know, Dan and I have both played the game, and I see some kind of nuggets, but there's certainly a lot of kind of heavy Euro familiarities in the game, certainly. Who are you kind of designing this game for? Who in your mind are kind of the people that will play this game? Because it sounds like it's transitioned from what would be a light to midweight game kind of up to kind of the heavier end.
Well, I think we did take a lot from Viticulture for worker placement reasons. It still was very heavy, and it was actually heavier on the front end than it is now. There was a lot more math involved, just kind of like of a more space exploration type game where you're mathing out how much fuel you need and that kind of thing. And so those were the things that we trimmed down to give it that more Euro feel. And so as far as like our kind of our target market, like we did want to design a heavy game, but we wanted it to be accessible. And so as we added elements and the game became heavy, as we kind of went through the process, there was one point where we stripped everything away just down to its core and was just like, if we're going to make this complex at all the things that are complex have to make sense thematically, or there's no reason to have them in the game. And so from that point on, it became our goal was to make everything what we call thematically intuitive, so that if it's in the game and it's complex, it makes sense. So it's easier to internalize when you learn the rules and easy to remember. And so when we kind of went that direction, we were like, okay, this is going to be a heavier game. But because of that, we want it to be accessible. And so, you know, while we do think it appeals to a lot of the Lacerda fans, we also have a lot of people who say, you know, if some of Lacerda's games or other heavier games seem a little daunting, we wanted this one to feel like it might be a little easier to get to the table, easier to teach, a little quicker to play, just so we could hit a little wider market, because there are a lot of people who kind of are afraid to dip their toes into the heavier games or don't want to spend the 4-hour time frame to play it. And so we wanted to make sure, especially with the first game for our company, that, you know, we weren't just, you know, really targeting a very thin market, but that we could kind of hit a widespread audience that maybe wanted to experience something that was heavier but needed a little better of an entry point.
I think you guys have, yeah, knocked this one out of the park, and we'll pretend that Deliverus didn't happen. We'll see if we know people at BGG. We'll see if we can scrub it from the record. So it's
yeah, exactly.
I wanted to ask you, one of the things I really like about the design of the game, and we'll get to sort of the the graphic side of things, but the rule book, the way it starts by introducing the game by taking you on a tour of the floor, as it were, going through, and it's even, and the player guides are called the employee handbook. So everyone has their reference guide is literally an employee handbook, which introduces them and takes them through a tour. So without getting too much in the mechanics, could you give the listeners your own sort of tour of the game board and how everything sort of works together?
Dennis, I'll let you take that one since you designed it.
Sure. Yeah, it was, I liked the idea of having kind of a tour of the company to kind of introduce you to certain things. And we wanted it to be like that section isn't rules. Like it's more of a thematic introduction to all the different departments. But at the same time does kind of give you some idea of how that works in the game as well. And so we have the planning and strategy, which is the part of the board where there's different agenda cards that you can take that have powerful abilities on them. And then there's the progress track, which is kind of the timer for the game, or it tracks the how far along in the game you are, as well as how many times you've launched or accomplished a company goal. That sort of thing is tracked there. And then the headquarters is to the right of that, which is where the actual actions are. So we've got these different buildings that are called locations, and they each have two different actions on them. And so you can go to these different spots in the headquarters with your workers to take those actions. And so we kind of just show you that whole building, and the building has connections between the main buildings. And so when you put something in the network between those, you're connecting those two buildings together so that you can access actions from both of them. And so we just kind of give you a little thematic introduction to that. And then the manufacturing side is where all the blueprints are. And that eventually, so blueprints becomes, when after you build a blueprint, it becomes a shuttle segment. And so that's where you can, you know, pick and design what kind of things you want to have on your shuttle. And then there's, of course, that's where you can get new shuttles, as well as there's a company-wide silo resources are kept that players can take from freely because you're all working for the same company. And so we just kind of take you through all those different locations. We've got a sideboard, which is the marketing department, and that's kind of where you actually, we've got a list. There's a whole lineup of guests outside of the building that are waiting to go on a cruise, and you can advertise them to get them to buy tickets, essentially pre-selling them tickets onto one of these flights or onto one of the, you know, the cruises. And then we've got there's a little back office. And just as a little kind of Easter egg thing, if you look really closely at the board in the back office, you can see some motivational posters hanging in the in the area where your cruise consultants are waiting for them to come and schedule something. So take a look at that. That's one of my favorite things that Ian put in there. I
definitely missed that one. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely take a look. So that's kind of the whole, all the different areas of the board. And so in the rule book, yeah, we take you through that thematic tour of everything. We also introduce a couple things to look at in the rule book. So we have... Zoe writes notes for you, and the notes, and of course in the final version they might look a little different than how it is in the rule book now, but we're going to have certain notes that are like, if it's your first time reading the rule book or playing, like read all of Zoe's notes, because she's going to give you tips about different things for your first time. And so we wanted to kind of introduce like a character that's kind of helping you out as you're learning things about the company, and you're joining as one of these supervisors.
Yeah, that was super useful. I really, really appreciated that. And I remember seeing the rule book going, "Whoa, this is like 36 odd pages." But the fact that it's, you've gone to the trouble of actually giving examples on almost everything, it just makes, because a lot of people are visual thinkers. And so, which is why, you know, those how to play videos do so well on YouTube, because sometimes reading quite a dense rule book can be quite intimidating. But having those visual guides, having Zoe's little notes going, here's a tip, right off the bat for first timers. I think that's a great way for people who are wanting to get into some of these heavier type games to sort of help them get into something like this. And having the really clear examples is cool. I wanted to ask you, how much research did the three of you do on actual cruise ships? Because having worked on a cruise ship for a couple of contracts back in my early days, I had a ball picking and choosing, and some crazy little spaceships that I made where there's scuba diving and wine tasting, or there's an arcade and also a casino and a nightclub. So I was trying to make sure that I was building my space shuttles to accommodate the three types of passengers. But at the same time, I'm like, well, if I got a casino, I want this next to the casino. And I was trying to do it from I'm going to design an actual cruise ship as opposed to what's for my ship. But did you do any research, or did you have a bit of fun creating all that sort of stuff?
So all three of us love cruising, and we've gone on a lot of cruises. And so just our experience doing that has helped a lot. And then I think we all enjoy space. Like, I'm a huge SpaceX fan. And so just the fact of traveling into outer space and different planets and everything has always interested me. But as far as like the concepts of the cruises or the individual segments, I think it came from our experience. But also some of them were just, you know, things we made up or thought would be cool. And what was great about working with Ian on the art is we gave him the names and then he did the art. Like, we didn't give him any direction. He just took the name of the segment and created what he thought it would look like. He even came up with some on his own. And so it was just really cool to see these just amazing creations that he created just based off of just simple names.
I was going to say, it's really cool to see that we would, you know, send him like, okay, we're looking for these different segments. They're going to fit these types. And then most of them would come back, you know, with cool art. Like, they always had cool art, but it was like, it would come back the same as we expected. But then there'd be just new ones that was like, wait, we never suggested that. Like, oh, this looks cool. Like it was great working with Ian because he's more than just an artist. Like, he plays games. He plays the game with you. And then when he's doing the graphic design, it's like he's doing it from the point of view or the position of like a player of the game, because he literally plays it and then figures out how best should I lay this out so that, you know, I'm able to play it, or so that everyone can learn it easier or have it smoother playing. So it was really great working with Ian because it's more than just, hey, like, tell me what to draw. And then we say, here, paint this or draw this or whatever. And he gives it back. It's like, he was a big part of a lot of the different theming things in the game.
Yeah. So how did that collaboration come about?
So getting Ian O'Toole is no small feat. We actually, when we were very early in the design process, we actually emailed him to ask him if he would be interested in doing the art, and we never heard back. And I saw something, we're like,
what
bitter.
A jerk.
I know.
He's like, we made Deliver Us.
Yeah. Haven't you heard of us?
It's world famous.
So it's like, yeah, we emailed him, we never really heard back. We were like, well, that's not surprising. I mean, if you're making a film and you are, you know, emailing just out of the blue some, you know, Hollywood all-stars, you're probably not going to hear back either. So, right, that's fine. Whatever, we'll work up to there. But at the same time, during the process, we became friends with Shim Phillips, who has played the game a ton. He's become a great friend of ours. And we were playing with him one day, and TK can, you know, he can tell you the story of he and Shim's great friendship, kinship over their hobbies and whatnot. But we had mentioned to Shim that we're like, oh, you know, we would love to have Ian O'Toole do the artwork for this. And he said, I know Ian. I could maybe reach out and, you know, give him a little nudge. And he did. And next thing we know, we had an email back from Ian O'Toole saying that he would love to take a look at it. So he did. We eventually set up a meeting with him to, you can correct the timeline here if I'm getting this off, but it's like we had a meeting with him just to, I think, meet him, but then he didn't actually play the game for probably another 5 or 6 months.
I think that's right, yeah.
And then it was after that, he was like, well, I can't really start on doing the art for another 6 or 7 months because of like how far booked out he was. So it was probably well over a year between us actually first meeting with him. Like, I think we maybe first met with him in February or March of
22.
Yeah. And then it's like, he played it in September, August or September. And then, we got the first piece of art in May of 23. So it was a pretty long process of actually getting him. Completely changed like our timeline, because we're like, oh yeah, we could probably launch the game, you know, late 22, maybe early 23. And it's just, then we got Ian and we're like, you know what, we're on Ian O'Toole's time now. The game will come out when the game comes out. And it's been so worth it, because during that time, it's like, you know, we brought Dennis on board. He alongside us have like really shaped it into a game that I think that is not going to feel rushed. So it's like, in addition to providing amazing art for the game, Ian also kind of provided us the time to make the game truly as good as it can be.
Mm. And it certainly is. It's a very labor-intensive process. It's definitely a labor of love. Aside from kind of your conceptions of how long this would take, are there other things that have surprised you guys about the design process, or anything that you've learned from the process of designing this game?
I think for me, one of the biggest takeaways is how much I love co-designing. We have a lot of friends who are, you know, working on games or bringing games to Kickstarter, and it's just them. Like, they're having to do everything. And so, you know, debriefing after a playtest with playtesters is huge, because they can get input, they can talk to somebody, bounce ideas off of people. But having a team of three people, like, I've come to really love that. And so I don't ever think I would want to design something that's just, you know, on my own. I would always want to work with at least one other person. And so, you know, the design process with Galactic Cruise has really shown me that, and been a, you know, just a great example of like what a team of designers can do. And so I think that's why you see a lot of games have a team of designers, just because it's so helpful to be able to bounce those ideas and develop the game that way.
Hmm. What about you, Dennis? As someone kind of more entrenched in the hobby from the get-go, was there anything that's kind of surprised you or that you've learned from this process?
I think Tika is 100% right. Like, not only for me personally, like, I really enjoyed that process. Like I mentioned, like, I had designed other things on my own, and I really liked the collaborative process. But I'm just seeing it, maybe it's just in my head, maybe I'm just seeing certain patterns, but I feel like the industry is going to more of a, you know, collaborative thing. Like, I'm seeing more and more names on boxes these days. And in the early days, I feel like it was Kisling and Kramer, and that was about it. Like, I don't remember really seeing duos or trios. Like, it was always just one person's name on the box. You know, obviously other people were involved in some way, developers or something, but I feel like that's more common now to see like teams of people. So I think that is going to keep happening. For me, I definitely learned a lot, but was there anything that surprised me? Because I figured that it would need, you know, we'd have to do tons and tons of playtesting, which is what's required. So when I got into the hobby early, like I didn't think that I was going to be a game designer. Like, I just liked playing the games. And it took me more like 12 years of playing before I decided, hey, like, maybe I'm going to try making something. And so I got in to the design more like 2019, I think it was. And so having all that like experience of playing hundreds of different games and playing lots of different types of games, like, I've always considered myself more of an omni gamer. Like, I liked the Ameritrash stuff, but I also loved all the Euro stuff. So like I liked everything, and I really like the trend these days of kind of mixing those two a little bit more than it used to be. There was kind of almost a divide of people that picked a side, sort of thing. And so like just playing lots of different games, I kind of had an idea of what would be fun, like what idea is going to work. So a lot of the stuff, when I'm thinking about game design, it's like I can think about something, an idea, and then kind of just by playing it back in my head, like playing the game in my head, it's like, oh no, that's not going to work. Or, hey, maybe that could work. Let's try it. So I'm always of the, like, even if I hear something like, it's like, oh, should we try doing this? I'm like, I don't know that'll work, but let's give it a try. So it's a lot of like, you just have to try things to make it work. I think some of them, the more valuable things that I've learned is like, if you're trying something and it's not working, like just change it during the playtest. It's like, you can just change a rule or tweak something. There's no point in like dragging it out and playing it all the way through. If you know that something's not working, just change it in the middle of the game.
Yeah. Wow. I'd love to hear some examples of that, things that have just been kind of added in, or you played once like, oh yeah, this is it, or things that have or haven't worked.
It is interesting how certain things in the game, after it's like, hey, I think we should try adding this, it basically didn't change. And then other things went through many, many variations. So one of the things was the company goals. I feel like if I look back to our initial discussion of that, like, I feel like it's basically exactly how it was pitched. Very, very slight changes, potentially, but then other things like how the guests work, that took like so many iterations and just like just making a small change at a time until it became something that really worked well and was still and was thematic and like into something that we just loved. But that took a long time to do that. So like certain things just kind of click immediately. You do it, you're like, hey, let's try plugging this in, and then it works well, and then it just doesn't get touched. It's like, oh, okay, that worked out really well. And then other things take like so many different iterations and small tweaks to get it to something where we could finally feel like, okay, there's nothing missing or wrong. It's like, this is exactly right now.
Question for you, Colton. We on our Discord channel, we've got a special section for our Patreons, and we put out to the Patreons that you guys are coming on the show. Has anyone got any questions for the team behind Galactic? I always wanted to go say so. I want to say Galactic Circus because there was an arcade here in Melbourne, and so it just rolls off the tongue. Got to force myself to say
you
Galactic
just ruined
Cruise.
Our next game.
Sorry,
that was supposed to be a secret.
Anyway, I had a question from Carl Van Ostren, who's a friend of the show, is also from Merchant's Cove and Bardwood Grove. He asks, "What system or element within Galactic Cruise are you most excited for players to experience?"
I think experiencing positive player interaction in a Euro style game is something that like we've seen people get excited about, and that I think people will continue to be excited about, because so often people will talk about, if you hear the word interaction, it almost always means like combat or take that kind of stuff. But one thing, and this is probably also what I am like proudest of contribution wise, is the ebb and flow of markets in the game. So like our storage silo has resources that you can just take freely if they're available, but as you take them, they deplete. But the lower they are, the more money someone else can make if they raise them back up. Agenda cards work the same way. Like as they are taken, they reveal bonuses that the person who refills it gets. I think also just the bumping mechanism, right? When you bump someone back to their player board, not only do they get their worker back, collect a bonus, and those bonuses can get sweeter throughout the game. In fact, you can pay other people to use their developments. So there's lots of feel-good moments of players interacting that I'm really excited for people to experience. Because I feel like in so many games, and like Dennis was saying, like this has kind of evolved past year, but it used to be, I feel like it's either we are punching each other or we're all playing our own little game in front of us and no one's interacting at all. And we are doing neither of those things. It's a, you can very much be involved in other people's turns, but what they're doing is not harming you, but is instead helping you quite a bit. I was also looking through just our BGG forums about just other things that have really evolved. We're talking about things that have evolved throughout the game. And over the last, close to a year, last 9 months or so, I have dived into quite a few of those things just in our BGG forums about how different things have evolved, like the interaction, like, you know, really leaning into the flavor text and the silliness of the game, how things like, you know, technologies have changed. So there's been lots of changes. And then, like Dennis also alluded to, there's been a whole lots of stayed the sames. Like if I read you the original text that TK was talking about earlier, like you would think I was describing the game as it exists in 2024, even though it's mechanically wildly different. A lot has stayed the same. But yeah, I'm very excited for people to experience all that positive player interaction.
Amazing. I definitely understand what you mean about the silliness, and that's something I think I really appreciated in this game, is heavy games that can still make you laugh, but I can still have a very kind of odd cruise ship for a really, and I can imagine the kind of customers and people who are going and paying that for that kind of particular combination of blueprints is really kind of fun and can be quite funny. So I definitely think that that's going to be, for me, the thing that would keep me coming back to the games. That's great. So what else do you guys have in the pipeline? Aside from Galactic Circus, which we'll have to cut that out.
What's really funny is one of the games that we were working on before we kind of went, you know, heavy into Galactic Cruise was a circus game.
Get out.
No, it really was. It was initially called The Extraordinaire. And it was running a traveling circus and different things. It's now shifted themes and mechanics, and so we've kind of tabled it. We've got a lot of games that are like early on, but our main focus the last, I guess, year and a half has been Galactic Cruise. So once we launch it, the next thing that we have planned is a bigger expansion for Galactic Cruise that really dives into the destinations. Because right now when you land on a destination, you score some points. And we have some really cool ideas about, you know, potentially dropping passengers off, picking them up, letting them stay at the destinations, building up the destinations, making them better, things like that. And so that's something we really want to explore as probably our next big project. As far as different games, I think there's a lot that are on the table right now that we're kind of working through, but nothing, you know, kind of set in stone as the next game after Galactic Cruise.
Where can people find you? When can they be expecting this game to launch?
Yeah, so our website is kinzenkeygames.com. Right now it takes you just a landing page of Galactic Cruise where you can drop your email if you want to sign up for that. And that'll shoot you a link to like our Facebook, our Discord. And then, of course, you can find Galactic Cruise on BGG as well. And the game will launch on Kickstarter March 4th at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, I believe.
Well, that's super exciting. Best of luck to you guys. We're really keen to watch this project. And I'll plug as well for the community. Paul Grogan, who's a wonderful member of the community, has an outstanding video playthrough of the game. Alrighty. Well, with that, we might move to talk a bit about the games that we've been playing recently. So, TK, I'd love to hear from you. Is there anything else that you have tabled recently or that other games been enjoying?
Yeah, so whenever Dan sent over the email and was saying, hey, this is probably going to be a question we're going to talk about, the thing that immediately came to my mind is the exact opposite of Galactic Cruise. So it's very interesting because normally I skew very heavy, but we got the chance to play a game. We were meeting with Joe, who is one of the owners of Allplay. We've partnered with them to do some stuff for Galactic Cruise. And he was showing us some prototypes he had. And he brought out a game called Things in Rings, which they've just started announcing. And so he taught it, and we played it several times. And I absolutely loved it. And I haven't stopped thinking about it. And we got to see some of the art. I don't know. I think they've started sharing it publicly. Some of the kind of Dr. Seuss-ish kind of looking artwork, which looks incredible. Very excited to get in and play it again.
I've never heard of this game. What is it? How does it play?
Yes, so there are three rings that form a kind of a Venn diagram. And everybody has cards. And there's one person who is, I think, what's called the knower. The knower knows. And the knower knows what each ring is. And I think one has to do with the makeup of the object, like its size or weight. The other one is kind of where it fits in culturally. And do y'all remember what the third ring is?
The other one is like the word itself, like the actual like.
Okay, like if it has two S's or, you know, double letters or something like that. And so, yeah, so all the other players are given cards. And on your turn, you place a card into a ring or into one of the sections you think it belongs in the diagram. And the knower takes the card and moves it to the correct one if it's wrong, or if it's right, then you get to go again. And so if it's wrong, you draw up another card. So the whole aim of the game is to get rid of your cards. And so if you're right when you place it, you obviously get to keep going and you don't have to draw another card. But if you're wrong, you draw up another card. And so it's a really fun puzzle to try and figure out what each ring is. And as, you know, more cards are placed, it starts to kind of reveal more about each ring and you kind of start to have an understanding of that. So just trying to figure out that puzzle was so much fun.
Sounds great.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like another cool sort of party style game.
I found that for TK to be such a heavy gamer, if there was a really smart party game, I feel like that's like right under heavy games for him.
100%.
It's like he hates party games except for this very small facet of party games, which he loves, which I think is hilarious.
I feel like when we've got a little bit more time, I should get you guys into some more playtests with Peter. So the designer of Things and Rings, I actually playtested like a really early version of it online. Because some of the stuff you're describing, I was like, I don't think it quite worked like that back when I played it. But it was the same general concept, of course. And Peter's great, and he makes a lot of different things like that. Like, I think you would like more of his stuff if you like that one. He's got tons of little cool ideas like that.
Yeah, I just love the puzzle nature of trying to figure something out. Like, if I can be smart and try to figure something out, that's something I love. Which I think is very, you know, present in a lot of those strategic Euro games, right? Trying to figure out that puzzle. And so when it exists in a 15-minute, you know, party game, I'm like, sign me up.
Mm. Yeah. And part of the fun of those games is trying to work out how the knower or her, the person who's crafted that little puzzle, what the hell they were thinking when they did that, and trying to get inside their head as to what they've crafted, and everyone working together. Like, so Clover is another example as well where...
Yeah. I think the knower actually draws a card that tells them what the rings are.
Right.
But they kind of have the subjective nature of like, okay, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And like, how do I interpret it? You know? And so that's the fun part for the knower is like, does that card really belong there? Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Well, you know, so they have to kind of give themselves the rules as it progresses.
That's very awesome. Cool. Dennis, what about you? Anything that's been hitting your table recently in your very robust playgroup, which I'm so jealous of?
Yeah, it's funny because it's a sort of a double-edged sword. And I know most people are going to be like yelling at me or whatever, but so I almost never get to play two player games, at least the kind of heavier two player games, because we usually have four of us. And so it's rare that I play a lot of these two player games. But recently, so I know I'm a little bit late to this party, but I've started playing Undaunted Stalingrad, which is like the campaign version of Undaunted. So this is my first time playing Undaunted. I had heard a lot about it. And it sounded really cool. But again, like I a lot of times avoid getting more two player games because a lot of the ones that I have that I really like I don't end up playing very often. But this one, I was like, this sounds awesome. So like, I have to try this. And I've been really enjoying that campaign. It's been it's a really cool system. I like how the different like casualties that you'll take from one battle can affect, you know, your deck or your supply for the rest of the campaign. And, you know, if I blow up a building in one scenario, then later when I need to defend that area, that building's not there anymore. It's like, they just, it's so simple and yet has so much stuff going on that just like is tracked really easily by the systems. Like, I think it's a super, super good system, and I'm really excited to get the new one. I don't know when it's coming out, but there's like a Callisto 2200 or something like that. I don't remember the year, but everyone knows what I'm talking about, I'm sure. So when that one comes out, I hear it's supposed to have like, I think it's 1 to 4 players. So I want to check out what the 4-player mode, how that works, because that'll get played way more. And plus, I just really like the system, and I love sci-fi type themes. So excited for that one. But Undaunted Stalingrad, yeah, a little bit late to the party, but that's been really fun. I've been liking that one.
That's awesome. I still need to give that a try. I've got the base one and then the North Africa, I think, sitting. But I definitely came to try out the others. Dan, what about yourself? I can see there's one game in particular that I'd really love to hear about.
Yes, right. Now, the game I wanted to sizzle this week is the sequel to a game that was never really on my radar. I came to the hobby, I think Scythe was kind of the next tier kind of game for me. I didn't really have any friends who were into those sort of heavier worker placement style games. And so having the opportunity to play Expeditions this week, my God, this game, I'm not going to bury the lead, blew my socks off. Now, I did play it solo, and fortunately the automa is just silky smooth. But for those that aren't aware, Expeditions is the sequel or the successor to the Scythe series, including the Scythe expansions. And it sort of picks up a little bit after in terms of a storyline where everything has been settled with Europa and with Fenris, and now the workers, the people of Scythe are looking elsewhere, and the action storyline moves to Siberia, where a series of meteorites have started to crash land in Siberia. There's a bunch of scientists who go and explore and find out what's going on over there. There's some corruption that's starting to take over in certain parts of Siberia, and they disappear. And so the story starts, or the game starts, where you're taking your mechs and you're exploring Siberia, trying to find out what happened to these scientists that disappeared, trying to take care of the corruption that's starting to pop up all over the place. And it's done through a really, really simple mechanic where you only do one of three actions. You're moving your mech, you're gathering resources, or you're taking the action of the place that you've discovered, or you can play cards. And the game is at its heart probably a really cool engine builder. So you have these series of cards which are either meteorites that you're discovering, which will cut off and give you perks. There's items that you can discover, which will give you benefits to actually to progress further. And there's also quests. And some of those quests are, you know, trying to find out where these scientists went or doing other things on the land itself. And everyone has their own player board, but you all start off at the same base. And you're trying to achieve these four goals. And of the goals, there are seven or eight that you can do, but the first person to achieve four goals first actually triggers the end game. And so you're moving these mechs around. Now, we were very lucky because Stonemeyer and Jamie and the team were generous enough to send us the ironclad version. So we've got these really hefty lead figures of these really intricate mechs that you move around. And you're collecting these items, collecting cards, which you then play. And you can when you play a card, you get an instant bonus, and it's usually either power or guile, which is intelligence, I suppose. And during the game, you're using power and guile to reduce and eliminate the corruption that is all over the place. And you're collecting these corruption tiles, and they'll go towards endgame scoring. But the goal, when you uncover a section of a map, you flip it over, and then if there's corruption on there, the corruption actually sits on top of what would be the second possible action on that place. So there's a action you can take on that map, but you need to remove the guile in order to be able to have that second action. That's usually a much better action. It's usually something that allows you to, like I said, utilize one of your items on a permanent basis. So every round you can now use this, or you can tuck these upgrades, and you can earn dollar bucks for things that you've achieved during the game. So you're placing these cards. You have these cards in your hand, but you're placing them when you use them, you're using them on a track, and you get the instant benefit, as I said, which is either power or guile to eliminate the corruption. And then if you have the correct worker that goes with that card, you get a different benefit. And so you can find these workers that are close to your home base, but then you need to venture away from your home base. And there's three different sort of areas of terrain. There's the southern section of Siberia, which is closest to your base. Then there's the central, and then there's the far north ones, which are harder to get to, but often the rewards, as you would expect, the rewards are far greater, and the corruption is far more to actually remove it as well. Now, you eventually run out of workers, and so what you can do on your turn, instead of moving or gathering or playing a card, you can rest. And what rest allows to then take all the cards that you've played in this row, put them back in your hand, you get all the workers back on your placemat, and that's it. That's your turn over. So you've sacrificed a small turn of not actually doing any actions, but now you've reset your hand to start playing cards again. And the cards will often, if you can do well in collecting cards, collecting media rights, collecting items that you can use, you can often chain them together so that when you play them, you might get a benefit, or you might get benefits where they actually marry up perfectly with each other. And so you do end up getting this, developing quite a cool little engine. And it's one of those games where I started off going, I'm not really sure if I'm into this, because the theme wasn't one I was familiar with. So I was coming in completely fresh to the world of Europa and the world of Scythe and stuff. But about 20, 25 minutes in, it really clicked in terms of the game engine that you're creating. And everyone creates a different engine depending on what cards are out there. And suddenly your game sort of shifts in one direction because of the particular cards, because of the quests that you've fulfilled, and because of the items that you've picked up. And you're trying to find some synergy to try and really get things moving in terms of achieving these goals, upgrading items, wiping corruption off the board. And the interesting thing with the Automa is the Automa, when you play solo, you're just putting two mechs out, one in the far north of Siberia and one in the middle section of Siberia. And they almost like just patrol backwards and forwards and cross over the territory. And then at certain points, the Automa will have its own progress track. And so whereas you have to achieve these goals by actually doing certain things, where it's collecting at least 7 corruption or having at least 8 cards in your hand or having 7 workers in your hand, the automatic, as you flip a card over, it will just automatically move along the track. And at certain intervals, it will achieve its first goal. It will achieve its second goal. And it has up to 8 goals. So once the automatic achieves 8 goals, then the game ends. But as you're flipping the cards over, it will say, has the automatic achieved 2 goals? If it does, it's going to start removing corruption, and it's going to start doing things. It's going to really start to get in your way. So the game picks up momentum, because the further the Automa gets along its progress track, it starts messing with the map a lot more. And so it starts off slow and you start doing things, and now it's getting in your way, and now it's uncovering things. And so now you can't get those map tokens because it's exploring the map for you, and it's removing corruption for you. So you can't get, and so it starts to, it's almost like just block your opportunities to collect corruption and achieve that goal. You can't unlock maps and achieve that goal because the Automa is starting to do it as well. And of course it's just randomly blocking certain positions. So it's really, really clever, because the game, when you play solo, it doesn't outstay its welcome. It picks up quite a bit of momentum, and it was probably the first game took me about an hour and a bit to learn, but the second game I think was probably closer to 50 minutes. Once I knew, I had a better grasp of what I was trying to achieve by collecting certain cards, collecting certain workers to get the benefits on those cards. And the beautiful thing is that when you upgrade a card, you no longer need a worker to get that benefit. It's like a permanent benefit. You're only allowed a maximum of 4 items, and you're only allowed a maximum of 4 quests. But in order to be able to achieve some of those goals, it's really, really clever. I haven't had an opportunity to play it with anyone else. I'll be bringing it to the Melbourne Game Day because it's part of the Melbourne Game Day collection. So hopefully I can get a game with some people in the community. But if anyone was a bit trepidatious about sort of venturing into the world of Scythe, I'd definitely recommend giving Expeditions a go. It's a lot of fun, and just for something that looks quite common. I mean, the artwork is beautiful, and look, it's a Stonemaier game, so you know that the quality of the components and is there as well. But there's some really, really clever mechanics, and it's a quite a unique system whereby you're collecting cards and creating your own little engine. And then at any time you can just reset and rebuild, because maybe you've got some cards that actually can create a better engine. And so it's like, I'm going to refresh. I'm not going to move or take anything this turn. I'm going to get all my workers back. I'm going to take all my cards back, and then I'm going to start fresh and start building a more efficient engine. And having engines and mechs, it's kind of thematic in its own way. Have any of you guys had an opportunity to play Expeditions?
Yeah, there was a time in my life where I was, every time Stonemaier dropped a new game, I was like one of the first ones to jump on it. But I've fallen behind pretty sorely over the last year or so. So like I've not gotten it yet. I've not gotten Apiary, or I've not placed an order for Wormspan yet. So I'm slacking. But there was a time where I was get Stonemaier games as quickly as he could put them out. So yeah, I would love to play
that's
it.
Weird. What happened in the last year?
You know, I just got a little busy, you know.
He's working on Galactic Circus.
He's on a game. You know how it goes.
Nice. So, yeah, so that's my sizzle for the week. It's Expeditions from Jamie Stegmaier and the Stonemaier team. That really caught me by surprise, actually. It's normally one of those games, we have an opportunity to play some of those games. I was like, oh, it doesn't really play solo, and I know it's not going to be my wife's jam, so I'll pass on it. When I noticed it was solo, I put my hand up and said, look, I'll have a crack because I've known nothing about Scythe. So I've come into this really, really fresh. And yeah, like I said, it's just, it's not, in fact, I haven't even taken it down. It's sitting on my wife's desk right now. And straight after this recording, I'm going to have another crack at it as well because there's different levels of the Automat and I'm ready to take on another level.
You know that game you've been wanting for a long, long time? The one that's been on your wish list for ages? Yeah, that one. The one you've been adding to your cart and taking off again, umming and ahhing about whether you should get it or not? Well, I'm here to push you over the edge and say go to adventgames.com and add that to your cart right now. I bet you that Dean has a great price on it, he's got great customer service, flat rate shipping, and there's so many other goodies to explore on the website. Wonderful categories all organized to pick the exact game that's right for you and the group that you play with. So head over now, don't hesitate, to adventgames.com.au and add that game to your cart now.
Well, thanks for that chat, guys. That's been great. And now we might move on to some quick announcements. So we've got a few game days coming up. We've got the Melbourne Game Day, which is March 9th at Preston City Hall. Gumnut will have their pop-up store, and the team from Melbourne Executioners will be back running D&D one-shots. We've also got the Brisbane Game Day coming up, March 23rd at the Royal on the Park. More the Meeples have the pop-up store there, and also the entire podcast crew will be in attendance. So that's going to be an awesome event. So if you're in the area, get amongst it. As we keep talking about, we also have PlayCon coming up, which is the 12th to 14th of July at Hurstville in Sydney. There's going to be panels, Patreon events, game merch, so go to play-con.com. And Oceana Month is coming back for the month of March, so this is an opportunity to celebrate some designers and people within the board game industry from our neck of the woods, from Australia and New Zealand. We have lots of great guests lined up, so be sure to check that out.
That's next week.
Oh, you beauty, get keen.
So I suppose later, keep your eye on the socials. Later this week, we'll probably be putting up some stuff and letting you know who's going to be on the show. That's going to be very cool.
Very, very exciting. All right, now we're going to move on to the question of the pod. So last week's question of the pod was, why is gaming important to you? Dan, do you want to read out some of the responses that we've had?
This was a heavy question, yeah, and kudos to the community for getting behind this. Now, you probably see on the run sheet, Lauren, I didn't really want to abbreviate anyone's responses because they were quite in depth, but I felt that they deserved to get some airtime. So, Shane Murray on Facebook said, for me, having a child with significant special needs, there's rarely downtime between work, being a carer, a parent, and a husband. The small moments I get to myself are few and far between, so I want to do something that provides an uplifting and positive experience. I've found that board gaming provides that in spades with the many genuinely lovely people I've met, the ability to engage in a clever puzzle that lets me think outside the box, the escapism that provides me that short period of distraction from the stress and responsibility that continues to bear down on my wife and I. It's an amazing hobby and keeps on giving. There's so many facets you can get involved in, whether it's collecting, upgrading, sorting and ordering, reading the rules, playing, devouring the data. The other part of the hobby that I enjoy is the way it's evolved almost inversely to many other platforms. Way back in the day, albums, computer games, etc. came with cloth maps, fold-out posters, Dream Productions, luscious manuals, and then slowly devolved to empty cases and a download code. That's so true. Board gaming has become more and more increasingly over the top, thumbing its nose in a way to other entertainment media. Fingers crossed we don't need to subscribe soon. So massive shout out to Shane Murray. And I will actually say there were some other people on our socials as well that mentioned that, and I didn't want to mention their names, but that they talked about the fact that it helped them with depression, it helped them with problems in their life and with work and with home. And so, yeah, thanks to everyone for sharing similar similar responses. Jimmy Boss said, because it's a tool to connect with one another, as technology improves and gets our focus more on screens, this makes it easier for us to disconnect. I love how we can have fun over a game no matter who wins and just socialize and chill. David Campbell said, gaming keeps my mind active, gives me a variety of interactive challenges and puzzles to solve. Games also give me more time to socialize with friends and family, as well as lets me expand my social network.
Amazing. Some great ones there. I might just read one or two from the Discord. And yeah, like we said, get amongst these online communities, because there was such great chat about this question in particular. It was really, really nice to hear. So again, yeah, I won't abbreviate these because they're great. So Uberface or Tom says, I think the fundamental reason that gaming, whether that be board games, video games, D&D, even sport, is so important to me is that it is adult play. Play is so important for mental and social and often physical health. And we're so quick to encourage it in children because of that, but we seem to lose sight of that as adults and it becomes a rare thing. While we might not have the imagination we had as a child, having a system with set rules and bounds but maintaining complexity and mental engagement makes play much more accessible as an adult. And on a much less philosophical note, it's not a bad way to engage with my kids. And then Kenny said, because it makes me feel me. I've been into tabletop games for 20 years now, and I can barely remember a time where I wasn't into gaming of some variety. Being in the space to play, discuss, design board games is when I feel most myself, so having those times helps me regulate and just be me, which is great. What about you guys? I know it's a very profound question to throw at you, but I guess on a high level, why do you guys feel like gaming is important to you? I guess, Colton, if you had any thoughts.
Why is gaming important?
Easy lowball question. Just
yeah.
Absolutely. So in some ways, it's important to me because it's what I am best at, right? I would count it among the things that I'm best at. Like, I am not terribly, like, athletically gifted, like, on a sport field. I am not a fantastic singer or musician, but it's like games are something that I am good at. It's something that makes sense to me. It's something that I'm pretty good at, like, sharing with others. So I think in kind of a big way, it's that. It's also it's important because it is accessible. There is no prerequisite for playing board games. You can join at any level and rise to any level or not. You can play Ticket to Ride and that's the only game you ever play. Or you can play Ticket to Ride and 1,000 other games and you still are welcome in the hobby. So I think that's another big thing that I love about gaming is that there may be a small amount of people, you know, pockets of people who might, you know, gatekeep it, say, you know, well, Ticket to Ride's not a real game. You know, get back when you want to play real games. But for the most part, people that I've encountered, it's a community that's just excited that you are playing. And so being a part of that is important. And in many ways, being a part of that community is more important than gaming itself. Because it is a place where you are kind of met where you are, which I think is great, and it's a great place to escape to when life gets, you know, when life gets wild, when adulting gets hard.
As it often does.
It's nice to just play. It's nice to play, because play is so important.
Absolutely. I mean, TK, you're a man that wears many hats. Music and film, all sorts of things. Why do you think gaming's important to you?
I think for me, like, I kind of go two directions with it. I go, like, as a designer, and then I go as a player. And so first, for design, kind of as Colton mentioned, like, it's something that we feel like we're good at. Like, Colton and I grew up together, and so we are very entrepreneurial in spirit. And so we've made movies, we've made music, and they've all been okay. Some people have said they're great. Of course, we don't think they're great. But as far as, like, designing board games, it's something we actually feel like we could be good at. And so for us, gaming is important because it's opened up an opportunity for us to express our creativity in such a way that we think people will enjoy. And so that's been really fun to be able to create something that other people actually really, really enjoy. And getting to see that has just been such an awesome experience. And then on the play side, one of the comments you made from one of your followers really stuck out to me. It's that, like, it's playing for adults. And like, I just think that's such a great way to put it. We have a really good friend of ours who often goes with us to conventions. His name is Mark. I won't say he's old. I'll just say he's older than we are. And like, just getting to see him play games just like we do and like have fun and goof off and just enjoy the gaming experience at conventions, on board game night, like, it's so fun. And I would say most of my friends that I have right now are due to gaming. Just being able to get together and have fun as adults. And so for me, that is huge. Just the ability to hang out with other people who are my age, who are younger, who are older, and just have a great time. And so I think that's why it's important to me.
You know, at school, or maybe it's at work or whatever, where there's a question that goes around and then you're the last person to answer and you're like, everyone already took the good answers. What am I supposed to say to add to this? That's the situation I'm in now. So I think my answer is like a little bit of kind of what everyone said. I was going to break it down similar to TK in terms of, I think, you know, now gaming is more important in terms of like, this is my career now, you know, and it wasn't before. So that's kind of a new thing that's, you know, it's important in that way. But I was definitely thinking more as a player than as a designer. As a player, I think, yeah, it's a lot of the comments have already touched on a bit. I think for me, though, it really is, it just comes down to, it's just so much fun for me. Like, I just love playing games. And there is, certainly there's the connection, like playing with the same group so often. It's like, you know, we were already good friends before, but it's just, it is such a bonding experience. And one thing that I did want to touch on that was maybe slightly different than some answers, because I feel like a lot of times when people talk about, oh, we're able to connect over this game and just hang out, and you know, it's like the table of people that are just laughing and having the time of their life, sort of thing, like you're like, oh, what are they doing? They're playing this silly card game, and they can just kind of, you know, not think about it and just play a game. And I enjoy doing that as well, but I find like the time that I feel most entertained, I'm having the most fun, and even feel the most connected, even though from the outside viewer, if you were watching my group play like our favorite games, we might be four people sitting in complete silence, and yet that is like the best experience you can have.
Absolutely.
When you're just like so into a game that you're all just like I just love the kind of puzzle solving that some games have. I mean, there's many different types of games, and so not every game is going to give me that, and I like them all in their own way. But sometimes just sitting there in silence with three other people, and we're all just thinking about this game, like that typically means that we're having like a really good time. That like, that's not a sign of, oh, this game's really boring, even though somebody from the outside person might be like, what are they even doing? And like, how is that even, like, why do you feel like you're having a connection between people? Because I think it's just like a shared experience. So there's many different ways of connecting with people. And yeah, I think sitting in silence around a board game is one of them for me.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. All right. And so our new question of the pod, this was inspired a little by some of the chat we've had about, you know, entries into the hobby and the game design process and kind of games evolving and changing over time as you kind of play more games. So our new question of the pod is, how have your tastes in games changed over time? So we'd love to hear from you guys. If you want to support this podcast, you can always go to patreon.com/boardgamebarbecue. Sign up to access exclusive podcasts, episodes that we record just for our Patreons. There was one from just this past week about some gaming highlights for 2023. So be sure to check that out. But if you can't do that, there are plenty of other ways to support the podcast without donating. You can go to Apple Podcasts, leave a star rating or review, or Spotify's new star rating system. It only takes a few seconds of your time, but it means the absolute world to us. And you can also get involved on our communities, on our Discord, Twitter, X, Instagram, YouTube. There's lots of ways to get involved and hear from us, and links to all of our socials are in the show notes. All right, now it's on to the dreaded swearing of an oath. I'll start off and just quickly say that I said I'd play Lignum and I didn't do it because I got sick. I had lined up the time with Def and Dana to play this game, so I'll keep that and probably not double down because I'm still a bit under the weather, so I don't think...
Double down, double down.
Go on, I'll double down, Dan. I'm so amenable to peer pressure. Here we go. I'm going to say that my new oath... So recently we had a trade night, a big auction trade night in Sydney, which, Dennis, speaking of people looking weirdly at board gamers, it's just a bunch of people gathered in a pub, surrounded by people just trying to have their meals, and we're just throwing board games and money at each other.
Was it as frenzied as I thought it was going to be?
Yeah, there's like 150 people in the courtyard of a pub. It's absolute madness, but...
Wow.
Good fun. So there's two games that I picked up from that that I really want to try. So one is the flip and write version of Orléans, which is the Joan of Arc, is that what it's called? So I've got that one so that I want to give a try. And the other one that I really want to give a try, a game that I've wanted to try for a very long time, but never really just got around to doing it, and that's Verdant. So I've played Calico, I've played Cascadia, but I've never played Verdant. So I'll tuck on those two and double down and try eventually get Lignum played. What about you, Dan? How'd you go with your oath?
Good on you. Look, I gave myself a bit of a softball option because my oath last time I was on the pod was just to start playing more games socially. Mm. So it was, as I said last time, the boys are a bit older now, and so I don't need to be around for baths and bedtime and stuff like that. So I said to my wife, look, I want to start getting out and doing more game nights in the community. And I did that. I went to Board in the West, which is run by Melbourne Meeples, and caught up with the team there and played. I played 18 holes. I actually got taught 18 holes by the game designer, Ryan Boutier, which was cool. We played Oros, which was really, really interesting. And then Draft and Write Records, which I love a good sort of, you know, roll and write, but this is a card drafting and a writing, and it's got a record sort of music theme to it, which is very, very cool. I think I'm going to get out the purchase pen for that one, to add that to my collection. And that's going to continue. I'm already looking at the Oz BunnyCon, which is in Glen Waverley over the Easter break. I'm going to try and make it to one of those days because that Oz BunnyCon runs from Friday right through to the Monday, Easter Monday. So I'm going to try and get there on the Saturday and catch up with some people and play some board games. But my new oath, it just arrived yesterday, and you're lucky I'm here and not actually playing it already, is Seventh Citadel. So everyone knows that Seventh Continent has been in my top 10 for the last few, forever. It's slightly, I think, it drifted out of position number 2 or 3, and it's now sitting at 4 or 5 or something like that. But Seventh Citadel is here. I spent Friday night sleeving the entire thing because I went all in and got the map and the booklet and all that sort of stuff.
Isn't that a nice process?
It's just so calming. I was actually watching some how to plays and stuff while I was sleeving. It's just really sort of calming and therapeutic just to sleeve cards. Yep. Hence why all my Arkham and Marvel Champions are all sleeved. Aeon's End, they're all sleeved because I just sit there and it's just card games. I don't know why. I just gravitate towards deck builders and LCGs and stuff. So anyway, Seven Citadel, I will get it to the table. I will share my thoughts. I know that Mitch has got it as well and Def, so it might be a bit of a race. Or maybe we can all try and get on a podcast together. But I, Dan Harris, swear to play Seventh Citadel by the time we're next on the pod. And I'm pumped. I can't wait. I saw your eyes light up, Dennis. Are you a fan of the serious pulp?
So I really loved Seventh Continent. We played that one 3-player and had just a great time. I do find it is fairly group dependent. Like, I tried playing it with a different group and it didn't go over nearly as well. But yeah, absolutely loved that game. And so my copy of Seventh Citadel just came as well. I'm not gonna swear to play that one though, because we already have like way too many campaign games ongoing at the moment. So I'll probably wait a little while before starting that one. But yeah, for sure, like Seventh Continent is one of my favorites, and I just got Seventh Citadel in the mail. So
now, no pressure to join in. I mean, we know how amenable clearly I am to peer pressure, but if you guys wanted to join in and swear an oath, whether that be related to Galactic Cruise or game development collectively or individual things you wanted to play.
So I had my cop out answer, which was to launch a Kickstarter. But
I kind of feel like that's 99% done anyway.
If that doesn't happen, then that's, yeah, be a bad road to go down. Okay, so mine actual one is one that I've actually really wanted to do for a long time, but haven't. And Dennis is coming down from Canada for the launch, and Colton will be around. So I'm going to try to get them to do this with me if we can find the time. It'll take a lot of time. But my number one game of all time is On Mars, and I've had the expansion on my shelf in shrink for at least a year, and I want to play it. So I know it's got several different modes, and so we can figure out what we want to play, but that's going to be my oath, is to play the expansion of my favorite game of all time.
Fantastic.
I also have a copy of the expansion and have never played it. So I'm in for that for sure. Although that won't be my oath. That's a bonus one. Mine is actually, this was kind of an oath that I already had with myself, but it's not, you know, the next time I'm on the podcast, it's the next time I talk to Fritz. So there's this old game from the 80s called Liftoff, and it's about like the space race, and it's like super, like, it, because it's from the 80s, you know, it's like a super old school game. Like, but years and years ago, like 15 years ago, a friend of mine in the game group like found out about this game and was like, we have to play this sometime. But it was hard to find a copy. But apparently if you like reached out to the designer of the game, Fritz, like you might be able to, he'll mail one to you. You can like buy it from him directly, sort of thing. But we never ended up doing it. And I kind of forgot about the game. But then at ProtoATL, I meet Fritz, the designer of Liftoff. And he's got Liftoff 2.0 that's coming out at some point. So he's working on this new version of this game. And so I was like super pumped. I was like, I couldn't believe it. And I was like sending pictures to my group saying like, I, you know, I'm sitting here and there's version 2.0. So I'm definitely going to get version 2.0 when it is available. But after talking to Fritz, and then I've been like, I go talk to him every time there's a convention, and he's also there. And so I managed to get a copy of the original Liftoff.
Wow.
And so I have a copy of it. And so I was like, I need to play this before next time I see Fritz. And so that'll be mine, because I've been meaning to do it. So yeah, that I will swear to play Liftoff before the next time we're on the podcast, but also before the next time I see Fritz at a convention.
Nice.
Amazing. Colton.
Yeah, so I won't even assign a number to this.
That give me some wiggle room. Like, yeah.
Politician my way out of it. Exactly. But I will very often like make, you know, top 10 lists, top 20 lists of like my favorite games. And so many of those I've not played in a good long while, because I'm just always either like playing prototypes or I'm playing like, you know, new stuff all the time. So I want to, at the very least, like look back at what is my current alleged top 10 and, you know, at least try to get them played at some point. Though, slight cop out, I played Sky Mines, which is my number one game, just the other night, so I will excuse it from the list. I've played the Red Cathedral fairly recently, so I'll excuse it, but like, I've not played Blackout Hong Kong in forever. Blackout Hong Kong is probably my number three game of all time. I've not played it in forever. So I at the very least need to...
We played it.
I think that was the last time I played it, is when the three of us played it. And that's been... it's been much too long. So yeah, just like refamiliarizing myself with my favorite games, which almost sounds like the opposite of what a lot of gamers want to do. They're like, oh, I want to play more new games. It's like, I do want to do that. I also want to play all of my favorite games that I've failed to play here lately.
It's like that, isn't it? I was talking to my partner about Blitzkrieg, which is a game we love to play together. And he was saying, oh, yeah, we played it really recently. And I looked at the Board Game Stats app. I was like, definitely, we played it last month. We played it in May 2023. And it's like that, right? You think, oh, yeah, I really need to get back to these games, because it's always astonishing how much time manages to pass between playing these games that we definitely love.
Yeah. End of the year, we always do our top 10 episodes where all the hosts talk about their top 10s. And I always try and, in the lead up to that episode, I try and revisit those games just to make sure that, is it still actually my number one, or is it just there just for purely nostalgia's sake and I don't really want to, you know, usurp it with a new game? So I try to revisit them and just to justify, it's like, yeah, this is still a solid game. Yes, I still love it. Yes, it still deserves to be in my top 10. So yeah, no, that's a good oath. Look forward to seeing how all of you going. And I've already warned you guys that our community are like bloodhounds. They will make sure that you fulfill your oaths. So we need photographic evidence, or next year we'll get you back on the podcast and we'll hold you to it. We'll make sure that you fulfilled your oaths.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, guys, for coming on the pod. It's been a blast to hear about
see what you did there.
But yeah, it's been great to have you guys and chat about the game. I know it's a game that a lot of people in our community are really going to love. Check out their Kickstarter. And we, yeah, look forward to watching this and Galactic Circus and all your upcoming projects.
And so are Deliver we. Us 2.0.
Right. Exactly.
Hey, listen, I joke about it all the time. And at this point, I don't think it's a joke anymore. I'm like, I would love to redesign Deliver Us, like, based on theme only. Like, the mechanics be totally different, but I was like, man, delivering groceries during a, like, end of the world,
yeah.
I don't know if there could be something there.
We love a scoop. So there's a scoop for all our listeners. Stay tuned. The next game from Kinston Key Games, Deliver Us 2.0. Thanks, guys. Great talking to you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Thank you.